Welcome, everyone. Hope you had a nice break. I'm Freddy. I'm your session chair today. Next presentation is going to be by Lars Hermannschmidt about language security for application security folks. Lars did a PhD thesis on injection attacks. So that's sort of his perspective into parsing injections, languages, etc. Lars is also working for Rewe Digital doing security stuff, roughly. And yeah, give a warm welcome to Lars.
Hi, thanks a lot. I would have joined the previous talk with what I did in the past or what I'm currently doing. So I'm building security champions programs in 2017. But now I'm trying to talk about LangSec, what I did in my PhD. And actually, this is some years old, so if you find these things like outdated or say, hey, Lars, this is wrong, please raise your hand and let's talk about it. So what is LangSec? So first of all, what is software? Software is input. Or well, there is this von Neumann architecture where this great invention came that we do not have those physical machines which have one purpose, but where we can put in where we can put in data, and we call it software, and then these machines run it. And that's awesome. But on the other side, it's complicated to differentiate when it's software and when it's not. And there's this great term of Datenverarbeitung, so processing data, which basically gives the illusion that the machine can control how it's perceiving this input and how it's processing this, because it's wrong, right? So as an attacker, you can basically use this input to steer the machine into the position you want it to be, right? So the software determines what are the possible states, but the attacker can actually steer it to where he or she wants it to be. So what is LangSec? LangSec says, so language theoretical security says the problem we have all the time with security in the internet basically is because we write software that handles input manually. And we write it always again and again, and there are errors in this code. So as those two guys here, they basically speak a different language, and that's the problem, right? So when the output is generated in a different language than the parser reads it, basically there lies the problem. And so the idea of LangSec is like treating all inputs as a formal language, defining it as such, and then handling this with proper parsers and unparsers. Actually, I use the term unparser here because for me it's easier to say. You might know this as serializer or you produce output. These kind of things I call unparser here. So one could say constructing secure parsers and unparsers is as complex as running your own cryptography, so one should refrain from using, should refrain from building them yourself, but using them from a library. Some definitions here, what is this language I was talking about? Basically here I have this language which those components talk to each other. So I'm not talking about programming languages, but you might recognize these things I'm saying from a programming language perspective, but here it's applied to those communication languages. And here we have those unparsers, those light boxes, and parsers, those dark boxes. And in the first part, I'll talk about those dark boxes, so we are talking about inputs. Great recommendation from some years ago on some OWASP website says, don't trust input data. Nice. Okay, so what I do now, right? Okay, so next thing is then validate your input. Okay, so how to validate input? Okay, always validate input against the specification. Accept only those things that you that fit to the specification, and if it's not fitting, reject it. Okay, so don't be a browser, because browsers try to do magic things to make broken HTML to HTML again and still show it. No, that's a bad thing. Don't do so. So about input specification, I had got two different approaches here, blacklist and whitelist. And the question is, which one is better? Which one do you like better? Oh, okay. It depends. Why? Yeah. Exactly. And the problem was, yeah? Exactly. There could be unknowns, and most of the time you don't come up with all those unknowns, right? So that's the problem with those backlists. And as I said before, specify exactly what you accept, right? So, and a whitelist is specifying more exactly what you accept. That's why one should use those whitelists. And one note here, regular expressions can only recognize regular languages. More to this later. So where is LangSec coming from? Back in 2010, FX did a presentation at Black Hat where he exploited again and again Flash. Rest in peace, Flash. But he found LangSec by doing so, and he basically found so many bugs that he said, okay, there must be some way of protecting. So he invented this Blitzableiters thing, which was a plugin to the browser, which basically is a strict parser that recognizes the flash specification, and it does not crash. It's basically a good written program, and then if it matches the specification, it accepts this flash file and forwards it to the real flash plugin. And by putting the Blitzableiter in between, he managed no further exploitation. So he was not able to exploit any of its bugs anymore. So by just putting the hardened parser in between, he basically defended all the exploits and found LangSec that way. Now it's called Content Disarm and Reconstruction. You might find this useful for your Word documents with macros inside, where you put in a Word file with macros and out comes Word file without macros, basically stripping away the content. LangSec is describing some anti-patterns. One of them is the shotgun parser. So shotgun parser is basically a handwritten parser that integrates deeply into your logic. And it's scattered all over the place, and therefore, as I said in the beginning, an attacker can steer this whole program into all those different states. And the one thing I brought here is from the Apache Tika parser collection, the PDF box parser, and it's a handwritten one, and nobody knows if it really complies to PDF specification. And that's basically most of the time the problem with those shotgun parsers. You don't know to which format they really match, right? So we don't know. So the first thing I want to state one should do is, like, don't implement your own parsers. Just don't. It's hard. I brought here one of those regexes for email, and here we, for example, have catastrophic backtracking, and which is easily exploitable to a denial of service. And it's hard to not do so, right? So just don't. And maybe you heard about polyglots. I got here some polyglot collection where you have files, so binary files, which might have, or which are different files for different parsers. So it's the same binary, but you can put it into a zip parser, and it says, here, it's a zip, and exports some zip, and you put it into a JPEG parser, and it's showing a JPEG, and at the same time, it goes on and on. Funky file formats, very interesting talk some years ago. And that's hard, actually. How to write a file parser when you're confronted with these kind of things. So if you want to prevent those shotgun parsers, basically use some existing good known parsers, review them, put some fuzzing in there, and then work on that parsed input. And if you're really in the position of having your own language made up of some kind, then you have to define this as a grammar. Generate some parser and unparser, and then work again on those things. Talking about grammar, who knows the grammar? Hands up. What's the grammar? Oh, there's one in the back. That's awesome. So grammar is a construct from theoretical computer science used to describe languages. And it basically starts with this S, saying here the file description starts, and then there's this P thingy where it says you can derive from the starting point, you can derive what is constructed here, and there you can find those comma and line break thingies, which basically are the keywords in that language that I'm describing. So this way you can describe this language formally, and then from that generate a parser. This is taken from Antla, which is one of those parser generators that describes this one. And here, the interesting part is what we do in AppSec is all the time we care about those keywords, because those keywords are key and important for injections. Later to that. So how is this then looking? Basically, this parsing in the middle is done by this generated parser. On the left, you have the document. On the right, you have the parse tree that is generated from the parser. And on this parse tree, one should work. Meeting Chomsky. Chomsky did a hierarchy of those different language constructs. And I said in the beginning, there is this regular expression thingy most of us know. And this is the smallest thingy that is usable for describing languages. And so it's called regular. And when you need something more complex, for example, for the CSV thingy, you need those context-free thingies where you have those grammars. And this is all fine. There are proofs that from those, there are compilers that can actually generate parsers that really do what you do and what you specify in your specification. This is proven that this is secure. But if you move ahead and have a language that is more complex than these context-free, you're doomed, kind of. So XML is at some point in this context-sensitive space, which basically says you can always say, hey, later on there comes something, but save all this thing I'm sending you now, but save it for later, you need to parse it later. You can build up state all the time, so basically you at least have a denial of service problem there. And if you're getting more complex, so for general grammars, you need a more powerful machine, and this basically means Turing complete machines, so it's basically remote code execution by design. And fun fact, natural language is mildly context sensitive. I actually read this up, so LLMs are on the doomed side, right? So don't wonder if you can't really make them secure, because basically you can't make the language secure. And the advice here is to never basically use the wrong language, right? So there are folks trying to pass HTML with regex, and basically because HTML is at least context-free, you're doomed, you can't do so. It's just not working, you can't recognize this. So basically, don't specify complex formats. There have been folks who really struggled with this in industrial control systems. One note on syntax and semantics. Here I got a little XXE with me, and basically, this is no longer syntax. So I was talking about syntax with grammars all the time, right? So the application perceives something and recognizes it and then says, yeah, this is XML, all is fine. But what you do with this, so which semantic actions you take from that, that is a different part. So with XXE, it's the point that, yeah, there is a flaw in the specification thingy, but it's on the semantic side. So it's a program can decide if it really executes this, so you can configure if you have external entities enabled or not. So, something from theoretical computer science, Rice theorem says non-trivial semantic properties of programs are undecidable. Meaning, you can't, when you have a program and you have another program trying to decide something about this other program, you will always fail. And this is because programming languages are Turing complete, so you can specify anything you want, and this is why it's hard to actually figure out what it's doing. So what does it mean? All static code analysis are doomed. They can never be perfect because of this. And all dynamic analysis are doomed because of this, because they are just programs. They can't find those non-trivial things like vulnerabilities. of course, antivirus is doomed. I mean, there are papers from the 80s proving this. So, but we are still using it. But in the end, it's doomed. It's no solution. The real solution would be to actually remove this executable things from those formats you transfer. So with an executable program, this is, yeah, I mean, when you transfer them, you have the problem. But with macros, like in file formats, just remove those macros and the problem is gone. To the second part, and I'm a little short in time, so sorry for that, so we'll rush ahead a little. I have here a little bobby table, so now we're talking about injections. I skip some of those. So the most classical one here is the SQL injection, and the common theme you would have seen if I have more time is like whenever I use string concatenation in my code, it's like an injection. So when I do code review, I always search for plus, and I'm done. Basically, I don't need any more. Right? You find the interesting spots. So how does it look in a formalized way? Imagine on the left side, you have a program having this abstract, the state, those variables, those parse trees. In the middle, you have this thing on the wire that is moving. So the thing on the left side is unparsing this into this format, and on the right side, it's basically parsing this. So this is data transfer, right? So this is how it should look like. And then somebody put some nasty keywords of this middle language in this left parse tree, and all of a sudden on the right, we are not receiving the same thing. So this is basically in what injections are all about. It's on the unparser side, there's a bug. So when producing this output, the left program did a mistake and did not escape these symbols, which are keywords. And therefore, the parsing goes wrong. So important note, input validation, also it's called input validation, is done when outputting data. And most people got this wrong. Even from security folks, I got a lot of people saying, yeah, with strict parsing, you can solve SQL injections. No, you can't. So as I already said, these malicious input things are the keywords. And the interesting part here is where do we not have keywords, right? So in those MAC protocols and IP header stuff, that we don't have keywords, so therefore there are no injections. And these folks are working with length fields, and length fields are context-free, so these are safe from that point of view. Okay, you have to look about, you don't need to trust those length things that are in there so that you do not end up with buffer overflows, but at least injections are not possible on those kind of languages. So here a little bit more code. An insecure application of how to run parsers and unparsers. So in the top, it's basically string concatenation things together to produce some output for the second function. And so in the first place, there I used string concat, which is insecure. And in the second place, I basically used the regex for this comma thingy, which is, yeah, this is a parser, but this is a very bad parser. So don't do so. Instead of use those libraries. I mean, there's a library for CSV. Why should I care about encoding quotes and in quotes in quotes and all those things? I don't need to. There's a library. Just use it and work on those objects from the library. So the recipe for secure input handling is basically use those libraries. Don't write your own encoding. I tried myself and failed. This is really complex, at least for context-sensitive encoding like it is in HTML. There are so many contexts, and there was a study done, and they found that there was only one implementation in the world that did it all right, and it was Google, who had their front page rendered in that thing, and all the other HTML frameworks were wrong at some point. So folks even who purposely did this wrong in the first place. This is really complicated. Don't try this yourself. And when using an existing language, this is always a good thing. Then you're fine with using existing good parsers and unparsers. Do some fast testing. Try to input some keywords in there and see if they are encoded. If so, feel lucky. Otherwise, review the code and work on those parse trees you get from those libraries. If you're not working on those given protocols, first of all, why? I mean, there's a protocol for everything, so either JSON or Captain Proto should work for you. But okay, if you want to do so, you have to go the path with the grammar, define this thing, generate an unparser parser, and work on that thing again. In a perfect world, I'm also having this theme here, in a perfect world, we should not care about this. In a perfect world, all programming languages just provide us those objects. And they care about parsing. We don't need to. I mean, this is kind of a solvent thing. On Wikipedia, you find all those formats. So why should we care? Why do we need to do this ourselves? So it would be great if we could just remove string concatenation from all programming languages and just yeah, let the programming language support us with some meaningful inputs, not bytes, but with like those parse trees. Would be great if programming languages support kind of these things. So if you ever happen to be in a research project, then please remember this. Meanwhile, at Google, they actually applied this and were eliminating bug classes with this. So basically, they find different ones. So just here, this this injection part is one of those problems they found there as a fundamental thing that is broken. And what they did so is they provide a space where you can't do it wrong, right? So trusted types is one of those things. So if you build your environment for developers like you can't do it wrong because we have all those things in our environment that it's easier to do it right, you no longer fall for those problems. So my proposition would be solve it at the language level, but since this is complicated, Google came up with this, let's solve it at the platform level. This is what I wanted to say. And the stats basically say they succeeded with DOM-based cross-site scripting, or it's cross-site scripting in general, by just doing so. They came up with this environment, and so they develop in a safe way. So what should AppSec actually learn from LangSec? Input validation is a misleading term. That's the first thing. It's always complicated to talk to folks. When you say input, they say, yeah, when I read this. And then I care once about this, and later on they never care about this. And this is just wrong. And I mean, all those different injections that call themselves cross-site scripting, command injection, you name it, all those different names don't make it easier. So it's all about processing input, so you need to do this once at the parsing part, and then a second time when when rendering some output, and that needs to be done correctly. The other thing, computers are just machines, and even AI and large language models are just machines, and so Zast and Dast cannot solve undecidable problems and will fail. So does antivirus, and therefore this is there's no tool approach to this. One can try, but will fail all the time. As I said, the Google approach of eliminating bug class after bug class is the thing that should be done here for those injections. As I said, with the Chomsky hierarchy, these communication languages above deterministic context-free are really remote code execution by design. You can't make this any good by implementing those. You need to reduce them in order to make this all good again. And as the last thing, rolling your own parser is like rolling your own crypto. It's just a bad idea. And that's it from me. Thank you so much.
All right, we have plenty of time for questions. Please raise your hand if you have questions about LangSec, parsing.
Hi, thank you very much for the talk. I have a question. What would you suggest for legacy file formats, for example? Because there you cannot apply building a nice grammar or a nice from scratch, because you have to work with what is already there. So what do you also have suggestions regarding this?
One can always, so if you have a specification, or if you have an implementation, so a parser, which is recognizing something, and then where there is no specification, you first have to come up with some specification. And then you can try which parts of this existing parser you can cover with your specification. And then at some point you might notice, okay, I need more than context-free. And at this point where you need more than context-free, you basically have to cut this feature. So did FX with his Blitzableiter, where he said like, yeah, it's not in the specification, so I basically cut this feature because folks were using extra features, which were basically bugs, by the way, and to do some other things, right? Which worked, but yeah, this is out of specification, so basically cut this. And by that, we can basically those existing formats bring to specifications that are that are implementable. And to that one, there was quite some discussions with RFCs, if RFCs should actually have those formal specifications in them, so that one can basically use a generator. So once there's this RFC specifying how it looks like, and then you can basically generate it from there. Would be nice, but yeah, never really happened.
Cool. Any other questions for Lars?
If you could jump back to that topic, why the DAST and SAST are trying to solve an undecidable problem, that would be great.
This one, right?
The Rises theorem, if you could explain that for, let's say, DAOs.
Okay. There is a fundamental problem which is called the halting problem, so this one is a theorem around this one, and the fundamental proof is that there are hard problems to solve and there are easier problems to solve. And one of those hard problems is this halting problem. And there are proofs that it's impossible to actually solve this problem with a computer. Because that is, one can reduce, and this is what theoretical computer science do all the time and have lots of fun, to reduce problems on other problems. So saying, if I have a machine solving that problem, I can use that machine to solve these other problems. So one can say about relations, about those things. And there are proofs saying that when you try to analyze programs, you always run into this complex class of problems, and you always have this problem that Rice theorem says you can't analyze even the easiest things. So one of those easiest things is, does my program terminate? And those easy things are impossible to actually do with a small machine. So it's always requires to execute this program and to see if it really terminates. But this might take forever because you don't know if it terminates, and you run into those kind of problems. And as one sees, these are really, really simple problems. Like termination looks like simple at the in the first place, but for those Turing complete languages, so for our programming languages we use all the time, it's really complex to actually prove this. And then there's this twist. You could either say, oh, we are doomed, or you could say, I use another programming languages. So there are programming languages, especially for aviation and so on and so forth, who say it's important for us to know if we terminate, because if I do this in a cockpit, I want to have this terminated at some point, and my aviation is doing something, so it's important for me to terminate this thing that is calculating there within, let's say, 1 second. This is bad, second is long, but at least it terminates, right? And there are languages where you can actually prove that it's terminating. But then you need different programming constraints, and it's no longer Turing complete, what you use as an input language. So we could either do something like Terraform or whatever, which is not executable in that way, and then do static analysis on that one, that's fine, or we say, static analysis is not the golden thing where you can find all those bugs. You're welcome.
Any other questions for Lars? Okay, thank you so much, Lars.